Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Story 1. I always thought my grandma Ada was a little on the paranoid side, but I could never have imagined what she went through that night back in 78. She lived alone in this little house on the edge of town after grandpa passed, kept to herself mostly. But one summer evening when I was 12, mom got a call that grandma was in the hospital. We rushed over, not knowing what to expect. Grandma was sitting up in bed looking shaken, but okay. The cops were there too. Apparently, grandma had called 911 in a panic, saying she saw someone lurking in her backyard. But by the time the police arrived, there was no sign of any intruder outside. The doors were all unlocked, though. What the cops did find, and what had grandma so spooked, were muddy footprints inside the house, coming in from the back door, circling through the living room and kitchen, then going right back out the same way. Someone had been in there with her. Grandma told us she had been sitting in her favorite armchair that faced the big picture window overlooking the backyard, lost in thought as the sun went down. Then something caught her eye outside, a shadowy figure seeming to peer in at her. She froze in fear, too afraid to get up, just fixed on the dark shape looming out there. Finally, she grabbed the phone on the table next to her and dialed 911, quietly pleading for them to hurry. Someone was outside her house. That whole time, she never took her eyes off the window, off the figure that stood there unmoving. It wasn't until the cops arrived that she put together what really happened. The figure hadn't been outside at all. It was a reflection in the glass of someone standing behind her in the darkened living room. Judging from the footprints, he had slipped in the unlocked back door and crept up right behind where Grandma was sitting, spying on the frail old woman as she gazed out unaware. Why he was there and what he wanted, no one knows. Grandma catching sight of his reflection may have scared him off. The police said it looked like he hightailed it out of there. I still get chills picturing it, though. How long was he standing there watching, only a few feet behind her in the shadows? What would have happened if she didn't catch a glimpse of him in the window? I guess in a twisted way, Grandma's paranoia saved her that night. Story 2. This is unexplained, and probably just coincidence, but I still never mention it to my coworkers. I spent some time as a homicide investigator. We would respond to all apparent suicides and investigate them just to make sure it wasn't a homicide. Usually, we determined a motive for suicide and found a note or other indicator that the person killed themselves. One guy just taped a note to his chest that said, "Happy now, bitch," and made sure his wife found him after he hanged himself. But occasionally you get a case where all forensic evidence indicates that the person killed themselves. But there's no note and no discernible reason why this person would be suicidal. These are people in good health with decent careers and a seemingly happy family life. But who knows what's really going on with someone? Here's the part that freaks me out. I've worked maybe 10 suicides like this. The last three before I left homicide all had the same thing at the scene. These was a little decorative wicker lighthouse at each location. It was the same lighthouse, same design, and painted white and blue. It stuck out to me the first time because it was by the bed where the body was. But 2 weeks later, I saw the same damn lighthouse on another suicide and even pointed out the coincidence to a patrol officer. A few months later, I go on another suicide and I see that same wicker lighthouse. That's when it clicks that it's always been unexplained suicides. I go back and look at crime scene photos from every suicide I've worked. In two of them, I see what could be the wicker lighthouse, but the angle is off and there's too much junk around to say for sure. I don't know. I thought it was creepy as hell, but I transferred a couple of months later and I let it go. Edit. Well, that got more of a response than I was anticipating. To answer the question of, was it a serial killer, I very much doubt it. These were clearly suicides, most of which had no feasible alternative explanation. We work every suicide as if it were a homicide. An apparent suicide is almost always a suicide, but we err on the side of caution. Also, while serial killers are actually more common than most people think, they rarely leave calling cards or anything like you see in movies. It's usually some fucked up dude that has a particular taste. I really do think it was an odd coincidence, but it was still pretty fucking creepy. Story 3. I've been an EMT for about 5 years now, and I've seen my fair share of weird stuff. But there's one call that still haunts me to this day. It happened about 2 years ago, and I still can't wrap my head around what I saw. It was a crisp autumn evening, just as the sun was setting. My partner Jake and I got a call about a cyclist who'd been hit by a car in a quiet suburban neighborhood. Pretty routine stuff, or so we thought. When we arrived on the scene, the first thing that struck me was how eerily quiet it was. Usually, with accidents like these, you get a small crowd of onlookers, maybe some people trying to help. But here, nothing. Just empty streets and the fading orange glow of sunset. The cyclist was sprawled out on the road, his bike a mangled wreck a few feet away. As we got closer, my stomach dropped. This was bad, really bad. The guy's head had taken the brunt of the impact. And without a helmet, well, let's just say it wasn't pretty. His skull was visibly fractured, blood pooling beneath him. It was the kind of injury you don't walk away from. Jake and I shared a look. We both knew the drill for situations like this. With head and neck injuries this severe, you don't move the patient unless absolutely necessary. So we started setting up our equipment, preparing to stabilize him as best we could before transport. I was grabbing the backboard when Jake went to check for a pulse. Standard procedure, even though we both knew it was probably futile. I watched as he crouched down, fingers pressed against the cyclist's neck. After a moment, he looked up at me, his face pale. "No pulse," he mouthed silently. I nodded grimly. We'd still do everything we could, of course. But at this point, it was looking like we'd be calling the coroner instead of the hospital. And then, I still get chills thinking about it. The cyclist's eyes snapped open, not the glazed, unfocused look of someone regaining consciousness. His eyes were clear, alert, almost unnaturally so. Before either of us could react, he sat up. "No, that's not right." He didn't sit up. He sprang up, like a jack-in-the-box. One second he was lying there, still as death. The next he was on his feet. Jake stumbled backward, nearly falling on his ass. I froze, my brain unable to process what I was seeing. The cyclist stood there for a moment, swaying slightly. Then his gaze focused on us, and he smiled. It wasn't a relieved smile or a confused one. It was knowing, almost mocking. He took a step towards his mangled bike, and that snapped us out of our shock. Jake reached for him, trying to keep him from moving. "Sir, you've been in a serious accident. You need to lie down. We're here to help." The cyclist dodged Jake's outstretched hand with surprising agility. He turned that unnerving smile on us one more time, then bolted. "Now, I'm no slouch. I keep in shape. It's part of the job." But this guy, he took off like an Olympic sprinter. Within seconds, he had disappeared into the woods at the edge of the neighborhood. Jake and I stood there staring at the spot where he'd vanished. For a long moment, neither of us spoke. Finally, Jake turned to me, his face ashen. "He didn't have a pulse," he said, his voice barely above a whisper. "I swear to God he didn't have a pulse. We called it in, of course. Reported a critically injured patient who had fled the scene. They sent out search parties, but as far as I know, they never found him. We gave our statements, filled out the paperwork, but there wasn't much else we could do. The thing is, the more I think about it, the less sense it makes. Head injuries bleed like crazy. This guy's skull was literally cracked open. He should have left a trail of blood a mile wide. But when the search parties went through those woods, nothing. Not a single drop. And his injuries. I've seen my fair share of severe trauma. That guy shouldn't have been able to stand, let alone run. Hell, by all rights, he shouldn't have been alive at all. I've tried to rationalize it. Maybe Jake made a mistake checking for a pulse. Maybe the guy wasn't as badly hurt as we thought. But deep down, I know what I saw. And it just doesn't add up. Story 4. I never believed in ghosts. Not until I started working at Blackstone Correctional. It's an old prison built in the 1800s, with a reputation that'd make your skin crawl. I took the job because the pay was good, and I needed the money. But looking back, I'm not sure any amount of cash was worth what I experienced there. My first week was uneventful. Night shifts in a maximum security prison are tense, sure, but nothing I couldn't handle. It wasn't until my second week that things started getting weird. It started with the dogs. We use them for patrols and searches, and they're usually eager to work. But at Blackstone, they'd get to the main gate and just stop. Hackles raised, whining, digging their paws in. No amount of coaxing or commanding could get them to cross that threshold. I'd never seen anything like it. Then there were the noises. At first, I brushed them off as the usual sounds of an old building settling, but they kept getting louder, more distinct. Footsteps echoing through empty corridors, doors slamming shut when no one was around. The kind of stuff that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. But the night that really got to me, that was about a month into my stint at Blackstone. I was on duty with Mike, an old-timer who'd been working there for decades. We were doing our rounds on C Block, the oldest part of the prison. It was around 2 a.m., that dead time of night when everything feels a little off. We were walking down the main corridor when we heard it. Footsteps. Heavy, like someone wearing boots, running full tilt. Mike and I looked at each other, both thinking the same thing, escapee. We radioed it in and started moving toward the sound. But something wasn't right. The footsteps were too loud, too clear, like they were right next to us, but we couldn't see anyone. Suddenly, the empty cells around us started slamming shut, one after another, bang, bang, bang. The sound echoed off the stone walls, making it feel like the whole place was shaking. I turned to Mike, ready to ask what the hell was going on, when I saw his face. He was white as a sheet, eyes wide, staring at something above us. I followed his gaze, and that's when I saw it. A pair of old-fashioned boots, the kind with metal cleats on the soles, running along the ceiling. Just the boots, nothing else. They clattered along, sparks flying where the metal hit the concrete, moving faster than any person could run. I'd like to say I stood my ground, that I was brave. But the truth is, I ran. Bolted right out of there, with Mike hot on my heels. We didn't stop until we were outside, gulping in the cool night air like we'd been underwater. When we calmed down enough to talk, Mike told me about the history of C Block. Back in the early days of the prison, there was a guard named Thomas Blackwood. He was known for being particularly cruel to the inmates, always wearing his signature hobnail boots that echoed through the halls. One night during a riot, a group of prisoners cornered Blackwood in C Block. They beat him to death with his own boots. According to Mike, ever since then, people have reported seeing those same boots running through the prison, like Blackwood's spirit is still patrolling the halls. I tried to rationalize it, to find some logical explanation, but deep down, I knew what I'd seen. I put in my resignation the next day. Story 5. I've been a detective for 15 years, specializing in sex crimes and crimes against children for the last 5. It's a job that shows you the worst of humanity, but sometimes, just sometimes, it gives you a glimpse of something else. Something I can't explain, even now. It was a Tuesday night in November when the call came in. Midnight, give or take a few minutes. A young woman had walked into the precinct with a toddler in tow, reporting that her ex-boyfriend had raped her during a custody argument. I was on call that night, so I headed in immediately. The woman, let's call her Sarah, was sitting in the interview room when I arrived. Her daughter, barely 3 years old, was asleep on her lap. Sarah's eyes were red-rimmed, her clothes disheveled, but there was a steely determination in her gaze that I've rarely seen in victims so soon after an assault. I won't go into the details of Sarah's statement. Some things are better left unsaid. But I will say this. It was one of the most brutal...
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Cases I've ever handled. The kind that makes you question humanity and leaves you staring at the ceiling at night, wondering how people can do such things to each other. What struck me most, though, was how Sarah had managed to get herself and her daughter to the precinct. The attack had happened at her ex's apartment, miles away. She had no car, no phone, yet here she was, safe, if not sound. "I don't really remember how I got here," Sarah said when I asked. "It's all a blur. I just knew I had to get Emma safe." Emma, that was the daughter's name. And talking to Emma was the next step in our investigation. Now, interviewing children is a delicate process. As a certified child forensic interviewer, I know the importance of letting the child lead the conversation, of not introducing any information they haven't mentioned themselves. It's all about open-ended questions and careful listening. Emma was still groggy when we started talking, but she perked up quickly. Kids are resilient like that. I asked her to tell me about what happened at her dad's house. "Daddy got mad," she said, her little face scrunching up at the memory. "He was yelling at mommy, then he started hitting her." I nodded, encouraging her to continue. "What happened next, Emma?" "That's when things took a turn I wasn't expecting. The nice lady came," Emma said, her eyes brightening. "She was pretty and glowy." I raised an eyebrow. "Can you tell me more about the nice lady?" Emma nodded enthusiastically. "She picked me up and hugged me. She said we were going to be safe, me and mommy. Then she sang a song, but I didn't know the words." "What language was the song in?" I asked, curiosity getting the better of me. Emma shrugged. "I don't know. It was pretty, though." I made a note to ask Sarah about this nice lady later. Maybe a neighbor had intervened. But Emma's next words made me pause. "I couldn't see past the nice lady," Emma continued. "She was all glowy and bright. Then she went to the door and knocked. After that, she helped me and mommy to the car. Then she flew away." I blinked, trying to process this information. Flew away? I'd heard children come up with fantastical stories to cope with trauma before, but this felt different somehow. "Emma," I said carefully, "can you tell me anything else about how you and your mom got to the police station?" But Emma just shook her head. "The nice lady helped us. That's all." I wrapped up the interview shortly after that. Emma had given me plenty to work with, even if some of it was unusual. When I spoke to Sarah again, I asked her about their escape from the apartment. Her brow furrowed as she tried to remember. "It's strange," she said. "One minute, he had a knife to my throat. I could feel the blade, the pressure. I was sure he was going to kill me." She swallowed hard, her hand going to her neck. Then suddenly he just stopped, looked towards the door like he'd heard something. Next thing I knew, he was running out of the apartment. "Did you see anyone else there?" I asked. "Emma mentioned a nice lady." Sarah shook her head. "No, there was no one else there. Just us and him." She paused, looking thoughtful. "But you know, now that you mention it, I do remember feeling, I don't know how to describe it. Safe, protected, like someone was watching over us. Is that crazy?" I assured her it wasn't. "In this job, you learn to trust your instincts. And right then, my instincts were telling me there was more to this story than met the eye. We caught the ex-boyfriend about 8 hours later. He was trying to skip town, but didn't get far. When we brought him in for questioning, I wasn't expecting much. These types usually lawyer up pretty quick. But to my surprise, he confessed to everything in excruciating detail. It was like he couldn't stop himself, the words pouring out of him in a torrent of guilt and fear. When he got to the part about the knife, I leaned in. 'You had the knife to her throat,' I said. 'Why didn't you use it?' He looked at me then, and I swear, I saw real fear in his eyes. I swear to God I was gonna do it. Cut the bitch's throat open. But then, I heard a knock at the door. Thought it was the cops. When I looked, there was no one there, but I don't know, man. I just had to get out of there. It felt like someone was watching me, judging me." A chill ran down my spine at his words. They echoed Sarah's feelings, Emma's story. But it couldn't be. Could it? The case wrapped up pretty quickly after that. With his confession and the physical evidence, it was open and shut. He's serving life now, no chance of parole. Sarah and Emma are in therapy, healing, moving forward with their lives. But I can't let it go. In quiet moments, I find myself thinking about that night, about Emma's nice lady, about the knock on the door that no one seemed to hear, but everyone felt, about the feeling of safety, of protection, that seemed to envelope Sarah and Emma in their darkest hour. I've been a cop for a long time. I've seen things that defy explanation, sure, but nothing like this, nothing that stuck with me quite like this case. I've tried to rationalize it, of course. Trauma can do strange things to memory. Children often create fantastical narratives to cope with difficult situations. Maybe Sarah had a moment of dissociation, got herself and Emma to safety on autopilot. Maybe the ex's guilt manifested as paranoia, making him think he heard something that wasn't there. But then I think about Emma's description of the nice lady, glowy and bright, singing in an unknown language, flying away. It sounds like an angel, doesn't it? Story 6. I've been an EMT for over a decade, working the graveyard shift in the small town of Millbrook. You see a lot of strange things in this job, especially in the dead of night when the world feels a little off. But nothing, and I mean nothing, has ever come close to what happened last October. It was a typically cold New England fall night, the kind where the wind whispers through bare branches and makes you think of ghost stories. I was on shift with my partner, Jake, a rookie who'd been with us for about 6 months. Good kid, eager to learn, but still green around the edges. The call came in around 2 a.m. Dispatch said they'd received a landline call from 42 Elm Street, but there was no one on the other end, just silence. It happens sometimes, old folks fall and can't reach the phone properly, that sort of thing. So Jake and I headed out, along with the local PD and fire department. Standard procedure for a wellness check. When we pulled up to 42 Elm, something felt wrong. The house was completely dark, not even a porch light on. It was an old Victorian, the kind that looks picturesque during the day, but downright sinister at night. Paint peeling, shutters hanging crooked, overgrown yard. Classic haunted house material. Officer Ramirez from PD approached us as we got out of the ambulance. "Place looks abandoned," he said, shining his flashlight over the facade. "No power running to it either, according to dispatch." We did a quick sweep of the surrounding houses, making sure it wasn't a neighbor in distress. Nothing. After about 30 minutes, we called it in as a false alarm and headed back to the station. 2 hours later, the call came again. Same address, same silent line. "You've got to be kidding me," Jake muttered as we pulled up to 42 Elm for the second time that night. This time, we were determined to get to the bottom of it. The fire chief, a gruff old guy named Bill, decided we should do a thorough search of the house. "Ramirez, you and your partner take the ground floor. My guys will sweep the second floor. You two," he pointed at Jake and me, "check out the basement." I'll admit, I wasn't thrilled about the basement assignment. There's something about old house basements that just creeps me out. But I wasn't about to let the rookie see me sweat, so I nodded and led the way. The front door creaked open with an ominous groan that echoed through the empty house. Our flashlight beams cut through the darkness, illuminating peeling wallpaper and dusty floors. No furniture, no signs of life, just emptiness and a musty smell that spoke of years of abandonment. We found the basement door off the kitchen. It was slightly ajar, a gaping maw of darkness beyond. I glanced at Jake, saw the apprehension in his eyes, and gave him what I hoped was a reassuring nod. "After you, Proby," I said, trying to keep my voice light. The stairs creaked under our weight as we descended. The beam of my flashlight revealed a typical old basement. Concrete floors, stone foundation walls, cobwebs in every corner. But there was something else, something I couldn't quite put my finger on. A heaviness to the air, maybe, or a stillness that felt unnatural. We were about halfway across the room when it happened. The temperature dropped suddenly, drastically. I'm talking a good 20 degrees in the span of seconds. I could see my breath clouding in front of me. "Did you feel that?" Jake whispered, his voice tight with tension. I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. That's when I heard it, a soft scraping sound, like something being dragged across concrete. It was coming from behind us, from the dark corner we just passed. I turned, sweeping my flashlight beam back the way we'd come. Nothing. Just empty space and dancing dust motes in the light. Probably just rats, I said, more to convince myself than Jake. That's when Jake screamed. I whirled around to see him stumbling backward, eyes wide with terror. Something grabbed me, he yelled, his voice echoing off the stone walls. Something fucking grabbed my ankle. I didn't wait to see what it was. Training kicked in, and I grabbed Jake by the arm, hauling him towards the stairs. We took them two at a time, bursting out into the kitchen where we nearly collided with Ramirez and the fire crew. What the hell happened down there? Bill demanded, taking in our pale faces and Jake's shaking hands. Before I could answer, a cold draft washed over us. I saw Bill's eyes widen, watched as he shivered involuntarily. Did anyone else feel that? He asked, looking around at our group. One by one, we all nodded. Without another word, we filed out of the house and into the crisp night air. It felt like stepping out of a freezer and into a warm room. We stood in a circle on the overgrown lawn, each lost in our own thoughts. Finally, Ramirez broke the silence. So, anyone want to tell me what the fuck just happened in there? No one had an answer. We filed our reports, careful to stick to the facts. Abandoned house, possible squatter activity, nothing found. But we all knew there was more to it than that. I thought that was the end of it. I was wrong. 3 hours later, as Jake and I were finishing up some paperwork at the station, the call came in again. 42 Elm Street. Silent line. Dispatch sounded confused. I know you guys already checked it out, but protocol says we have to send someone. I shared a look with Jake. The kid still looked shaken from our earlier experience. We'll drive by, I told dispatch. But we're not going inside without backup. The street was quiet as we pulled up to the house. Nothing had changed. Same dark windows, same overgrown yard. But as I killed the engine, I swear I saw a flicker of movement behind one of the upstairs windows. Just for a second, like someone passing by. Jake saw it too. Tell me that was just a trick of the light, he said, his voice barely above a whisper. I wished I could, but I knew what I'd seen. We sat there for a good 10 minutes, engine off, just watching the house. Nothing moved. No sounds except for the whisper of wind through dead leaves. Finally, I started the ambulance. Let's get out of here, I said. Jake didn't argue. As we pulled away, I glanced in the rearview mirror. For just a moment, I thought I saw a figure standing on the porch. Pale, indistinct, barely there. Then we turned the corner, and it was gone. Jake quit a month after that night. Said the job wasn't for him. Can't say I blame him. This line of work, it changes you. Makes you see the world differently. Makes you question what's real and what isn't. But me, I'm still here. Still answering calls in the dead of night. Because for every inexplicable, terrifying moment like 42 Elm, there are 100 times when we make a real difference. When we save a life, ease someone's pain, bring a little light into the darkness.
Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.